Your Royal Highness, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to this, our 150th anniversary. I shy away from asking if you can all hear me, in part because a few years ago my wife Di and I attended a function in New Zealand and the speaker posed just that question, could we all hear him? A man at the back of the room flung his arm up and said, yes, he said, I can hear you, but I'll gladly swap places with someone who can't. Thank you, Toastmaster, for introducing me as being from Australia. I now have some empathy with Manuel, who was forever introduced by Basil as being from Barcelona. A different connotation, I hope. Australia, of course, has a long association with Portsmouth. In the late 18th century, many of our first settlers sailed from or through this magnificent port, albeit under very difficult circumstances. I suppose the only redeeming factor then of international travel was that they didn't have to go through the Heathrow immigration queues. Well, what an overwhelming and magnificent event this is. The word gravitas comes readily to mind. A night for reflection on the part that HMS Worcester, where we trained to join the Merchant Navy, played in the good fortune of our lives. Firstly, we should thank the small committee who have devoted several years of their lives to this organising these 3 days, mostly on their own, without any form of professional help. To the chairman, Clive Bradbury, your wife, Sarah, and your committee, we thank you all. For the complex task of seating 577 people tonight and collecting of the monies, we have Roger Boatman to thank. If you're not sitting next to your wife tonight, you can blame Roger. If you are, but would rather be sitting next to somebody else's wife, you can also blame Roger. Consideration was given in the early piece to allocating tables by health episodes. Those who had bypasses would all be assembled on the same table. Those with stents, those with hip replacements, etc., would sit together. But it quickly became apparent that there were a number of senior male ailments for which no tables were big enough. More about bromide later. This is the largest gathering ever of our Worcesters, and probably of foreign-going master mariners. For those who don't know, foreign going simply meant was an endorsement that we were allowed to lose sight of land without panicking. And because there are so many yachties here tonight, I'd just like to tell this little tale. Of the two yachties who were having a drink one night, one an offshore fella and the other an onshore fella, one with a white wine and one with a beer, I'll leave you to determine who had which. And the offshore fellow said to the onshore fellow, he said, tell me, he said, what do you do when you lose sight of land? And the onshore fellow said to the offshore fellow, he said, we do exactly the same as you do when you sight it. We panic. Now, out of a total of 557 guests tonight, there are 280 old Worcesters, which is quite remarkable when you think that our college closed 44 years ago. There have been almost 8,000 old Worcesters in all, and are currently 1,023 members of the association. There are 17 old Worcesters here tonight who were either at sea or on Worcester during the Second World War. And our most senior member tonight, Angus Baber, left the college in 1940. There are 66 of us from overseas, including 25 from Australia, 11 from Canada, 9 from the United States of America, 3 from New Zealand, and 2 from South Africa. We should ask ourselves why so many of us sought to attend tonight, and some of us to come so far. What is it that continues to bind us after all of these years, seemingly until the end? My colleague, David Precious, your immediate past president, and here tonight with his wife, Arlene, has said to me on a number of occasions that he is humbled when he attends funerals of old Worcesters who have crossed the bar to see our Worcester ensign draped upon the casket. Why? We were not in the armed forces. We spent only 2 or 3 years at Worcester. Our contemporaries in boarding schools across the United Kingdom would spend a decade or more in those schools, but I suspect had few such lasting bonds. Perhaps a clue lies here. In his preface to our college handbook, the Earl of Inchcape wrote, "A ship life imparts to a boy a degree of disciplined self-confidence, which in itself is a guarantee of success in life and distinguishes him from the boy ashore." Now it is true that whilst many of us found much to be happy about on the Worcester, our lives were both Spartan and tough. We froze in the winter, the summers were stifling with the attendant smells. Unspeakable things were washed up in our gratings and on the causeway by the mighty ebb tides of the Thames. If you fell into the Thames, it was automatically 2 weeks in quarantine. Every time I see Thames scallops on a menu, I turn to move on quickly. And if I see Thames trout, I tend to walk out. And then there were the suffocating pea soup fogs, the killer fogs of London of the early 50s. We slept in hammocks slung above our black sea chests in which our worldly goods were stowed. And in order to settle we lusty young boys down, we were given a healthy dose of bromide and our cocoa before lights out every night. My friend Mike Bartlett here tonight with his wife Cassandra reminded me only last night that on Sophie Loren film nights we were given a double dose of bromide. Just a few years ago, Di and I had dinner with my good friend John Eastwood, who is here tonight with his wife Jane. And at the end of the meal, I said to John, "Do you remember the bromide?" And John leant back and reflectively thought and said to me, "Yes," he said, "I remember the bromide." He said, "It's just beginning to work." And I thought, "You lucky lad." Now, we're having dinner with him tomorrow night, so I'll be able to give you a progress report on the bromide situation at the 175th anniversary. We slewed around the upper deck arm in arm every evening, a practice which today would attract the attention and probable ire of the European Commissioner for something, probably anti-friendship. And we were very young. Many of us were war babies, having endured 13 years of rationing and liberal doses of rosehip syrup. I recall that during my first year, a few of us were summoned to the tier deck for instruction in crowd control in foreign lands. I was 15. By Pincher Martin, our phys ed instructor at the time. Most of the content could be distilled into "don't get involved." Towards the end, clearly inspired, Pincher trance-like went down on his haunches and announced that now we had come to the how to handle an attack by a mad dog section. Clearly, this was his speciality. Our instructions were to firstly look the dog in the eyes to attract its attention, to place our left forearm in front of our throat, to allow the dog to launch itself at our left forearm and dig its teeth in. At the same time, our right hand was to go down and lean forward to grab at whatever we found there and pull them off. I repeat, I was 15 and I kept rabbits at home. Young Barnes, who had clearly been to places that none of the rest have been, said to Mr. Martin, he said, "Excuse me, Mr. Martin, but what happens if it's a female dog?" To which Pincher came back quick as a flash and said, "Barnes, all mad attack dogs are male." And so why, despite all, this bond? I've always been attracted to the simple story of Lawrence of Arabia. Every night before he went to bed, Lawrence would snuff his candle out with his bare fingers, and every night his batman would say to him, "But sir, that must hurt." And he would say in response, "Yes, it does hurt, but the secret is in not minding that it hurts." And we didn't mind that some of our life hurt on Worcester, because we all had a common goal. We were all going to sea. We lived with a common ethos and a panoply of passing ships on the Thames. Indeed, we were the only Merchant Navy College to enjoy this. In our time, the Thames was both the engine and the vein of the empire, which at its height ruled over a quarter of the world's population. England was the third richest nation in the world. There were more ships under construction in the United Kingdom than in America, Japan, and Germany combined. and Britain was indeed the preeminent maritime nation. When my grandfather went to sea at the turn of the last century, one half of all the ships in the world flew the Red Ensign, and a third of all the cargoes were carried in British bottoms. In 1957, there were over 2,000 British foreign-going vessels. By 2008, there were just 207. Our ship Worcester, permanently moored at Greenhithe, was framed upriver by Everard's shipyard with its countless working coasters, latterly the Yellow Perils, and its magnificent Thames spritsail barges. Until 1954, for 16 years, the Cutty Sark lay moored but a few ship lengths off the Worcester. And downriver, our ship was framed by Reed's paper mills with its belching smokestacks and the bow-water ships at its moorings, freshly rusted from the North Atlantic storms and their distinctive winter North Atlantic marks on their load lines. Ashore, of course, was the magnificent Ingress Abbey, owned by the Holder family, itself a shipping company, and our sweeping playing fields. And for all of this time, in the River Thames, the ships came past. The graceful liners of the New Zealand Shipping Company, with their cargoes of frozen meat and lithe young ladies from the Southern Hemisphere. Perhaps the most beautiful cargo ships of all, the ships of the Port Line. The striking blue star ships, with funnels often as big as their accommodation blocks. Brocklebank Line from India, and you could smell the curries from the Lascar Seaman's Galley as the ships sailed past. Royal Mail ships from the Argentine with their cargoes of beef and fray bentos. Pacific steam navigation ships from the rolling swells of the Peruvian and Chilean coasts on the west coast of South America. Ships of the shore Savile Albion, and of course the biggest ship of all, the Dominion Monarch, that went to the Royal Docks, belonged to shore Savile. Ships of the Elder Dempster line from the creeks to West Africa. And ships of the P&O Group, which at its height had owned 14 shipping companies, including the British India Steam Navigation Company, the livery of the Empire, Strickline trading to the Persian Gulf, and Hainline, Cornish Company. The ships all started with TRE, and the only company in the last World War to have lost all of its ships, some 33. Ships of the Grand Blue Funnel Line, whose ships were named after Greek mythology, the Hector, the Melampus, the Icarus, Greek mythology. One suspects that if they were still in business today and building a ship now, they would probably call it the Euro. The occasional transship from Hungry Hogarth and the occasional Athol Line molasses tanker from the Caribbean. On a hot day, you could smell the Tate and Lyle syrup in their tanks. Ships of the Elliman Group, Elliman Bucknell, Elliman Wilson, Elliman Papiani, and to add to all of this, the dock visits, busload of us to Tilbury and the Royal Docks. We did indeed live ships. My good friend Ian Sanderberg, who is here tonight with his wife Judy, has said to me often that we spoke the language of Cook and Nelson, and we did. We learnt the difference between futtocks and nettles, clinker and hard chine, a pintle and a gudgeon, a monkey's fist and a monkey's face, boiled oil and raw oil, a great circle and a rum line. And we learned how to split blocks, to parbuckle, to splice ropes and wires, to sew canvas, to box the compass, all 132 points of it, to worm and parcel with the lay, to turn and serve the other way. And we learned to make and mend. This, ladies, transfers as we can darn our own socks. You learn this after 60 years of married life. We learned to send and receive semaphore, cast a lead, secure a Spanish windlass, and to self-secure a bosun's chair, although I suggest more than one Worcester cadet ended upside down in the Hoogly or the Yarra when he forgot to pass the bow over his head and under his feet before letting it go. And we learnt Morse code. Pity the hapless cadet, in the middle of the Indian Ocean calling up what ship, was confronted with the Dutch passenger ship Johan van Oldenbarnevelt, all 23 letters of it. It was quicker than texting, and you can't do it whilst driving the car. We were certainly, in Inchcape's words, distinguished from the boy ashore. And then, of course, after 2 or 3 years, came our first trip to sea. There were over 50 shipping companies to choose from. The summons to attend our first interview was usually accomplished by bring enough clothes to join your first ship, lad. Frenzied phone calls to the outfitters S.W. Silver and Company of King William House, Eastcheap. Often our first job was dock staff in the Royal Docks of London. If we survived the Roundhouse pub in East Ham and the industrial attrition of Jack Dash and his dockers, finally we were off. Out through the lock gates to the dulcet cries from the PLA assistant dockmaster of Keep Her Off the Knuckle Harry. Thundering down the Thames on a full ebb tide, past HMS Worcester, dropped the pilot at Dungeness and down the channel to cross the Bay of Biscay. We were at sea. We would go ashore in far-flung ports around the globe, and despite the language difficulties, we would always find our way back to our ship. Indeed, there were only two expressions we needed to know in every language in the world. One was, would you kindly remove your clothes? And the other, my friend will pay. And on £8 a month, that last of those two expressions was probably the most important. We were always in trouble, be it in the Zillertal in Hamburg, where the words Lederhosen and spoons come to mind, the number 2 cherry bar in Yokohama, or the Seaman's bar on the Bund in Shanghai, which of course used to be the merit missions to seamen, and the longest bar in the world until the communists came to power and cut it in two. In our white uniforms, we thought we knew it all, but of course we didn't. My first day in the Bay of Biscay, I quietly approached the barometer and tapped it as my father had taught me to do. The captain came up soundlessly behind me in his lungi and said if that was supposed to be hit, it would be fitted with a punch bag. Now leave the bloody thing alone. He wandered off behind me, muttering something about squeaking sheaves mean bad officers. More normally, we were covered in the unmistakable grime and rust particles which evidenced our most recent deployment on deck. And I remember that when we came home, our friends who were young bank clerks or accountants were all envious of our travels and the lives we led. And to me, that always underlined our good fortune in having chosen to go to sea. As our lives moved on, many of us left the sea. Of those, many went on to serve ashore in the maritime professions, be it pilotage, superintendency, port management, Royal National Lifeboat Institution, maritime education, and some became examiners of masters and mates, the original gamekeepers. I'm sure we've all got very fond memories of our examination for masters and mates. A story that I've always particularly enjoyed is of the young 19 or 20-year-old who fronts for the oral examinations for his second mate certificate, an old Worcester who's now been at sea for 3 years. He's a man. He enters the room, sits at the desk. The examiner thrusts in front of him a battered wooden model boat with 2 yellow masthead lights and a red and green sidelight. He says, "You know what this is, laddie?" "Yes, sir." "You know where Muckle Flugger is, laddie?" "Yes, sir." Now, relieved that seemingly he's answered 2 questions to the examiner's satisfaction. "Well, I want you to imagine that you're anchored in the lee of Muckle Flugger and the wind gets up. What are you going to do?" "Pay out more anchor cable, sir." "And there's more wind. What are you going to do?" "Pay out more anchor cable, sir." "More wind, laddie. What are you going to do?" "Pay out more anchor cable." "Tell me, laddie, where are you getting all this anchor cable from?" "Same place you're getting all your wind from, sir." Others went on to follow other worthy paths, and a great number of us remained at sea. And we're pleased to have amongst us tonight the serving Commodore of P&O with us. Commander Burgoyne, Commodore Burgoyne, will be the last old Worcester in this illustrious line to serve in that position. Now, we've all gone on to be what we are, and in that, we need forever to be grateful to our good and proud ship, Worcester. I thank you.